From the Jackalope Studios high above the city in beautiful Zona Rosa, welcome to Minutes to Memories, reconnecting spirit, mind, and body with your host, Dr. Daryl Drumright.
Friday night here at the top of Zona Rosa. This is Dr. Drumright back with Minutes and Memories. It's been a couple weeks since I got to talk to you, so I'm kind of jazzed up and revved up tonight. I'm very excited about our show tonight. We have a guest here tonight, and I wanted to start off by talking about something very happy happening in America today. And there's a movement towards locally grown food. People are starting to ask questions about how to grow your own food, about seed populations, and about different processes that you can go through to actually be responsible for the own food that you eat and your family eats, and proper labeling and these such things. Along this measure, a very good friend of mine, I call her Farmer Jennifer, but Jennifer Charlson owns a small farm north of Kansas City here called Hidden Hills Farms. And she's with us here tonight. We're going to talk about some of her techniques and what motivates her to do what she does, and some of the struggles that she goes through about being a small farm in a world that promotes only large industries and gets in the way of chiropractors and small farmers and anybody who wants to step outside the box a little bit. Good evening, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you very much for being here. It's quite an honor to sit across from you on the radio show as we make history and turn minutes into memories. So, Jennifer, are you from Missouri?
Yes, I was born in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Spent years back and forth between Oklahoma and this area. But mm-hmm. for the most part, I grew up here north of the river.
And how long have you been farming?
You know, that came as a process. It was never, there was never like, you know, we started a business on this date. For the last 7 years, it's kind of grown, you know, incrementally throughout the time period. But really, there are so many aspects to this that started way before that. Mm-hmm. So pretty much the last 7 years has grown. The last three or four has grown very quickly, which has been wonderful.
But excellent. So did you start off with a conventional farming system and move on to this more natural way? Or did you just get after it right off the bat thinking that you want to do this a new way?
It's funny you should ask that. Damon, my partner in this business, he grew up in conventional farming, mm-hmm. And was not in conventional farming when we met. I did not. I not only knew nothing about cows, had never seen a cow, had never touched a cow, and really, I have always been driven to do it from a natural standpoint. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what organic meant. I just had an internal drive to do it a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that is where I spent time researching and reading and visiting places and just basically driving other, you know, farmers nuts, trying to gather information. And it was very much a self-taught situation. So no, I did not come from any farming.
Okay.
Damon did, which has made a really fantastic teamwork between the two of us, because I bring in the clean, what I call a clean idea, not just clean, chemical-free clean, but not hasn't been tainted with somebody else's opinion of how something should be put together.
Okay, yeah, like fresh.
Exactly, and he is the reality. He knows he can take an idea that I bring in, and he's open-minded enough to view it different than what he was taught, mm-hmm. but he knows how to work the whole system in general. And so
he can say this, no, that's not going to work.
Exactly. He tells me all the time, just because you read a book from somebody that lives in California doesn't mean it's going to work in Missouri.
It's not going to work in Missouri. Wow. So I want to get into a little more details of what you got, what you've developed up there. So 7 years ago, you got started on this. I would ask you right off the bat is what kind of influence you think the internet has had on your ability to do the things the way you've done?
Oh my goodness. It's been huge. From not only a learning standpoint, but a marketing standpoint. Mm-hmm. The first time we brought home dairy cows, I had spent a long time convincing Damon's dad to let me have one dairy cow on his land. It worked. Damon was shocked. We went for cows and brought home eight, which was whole story on its own. And Damon was under the impression I was going to sell all but one, but that never happened. So anyway, to make a long story short, I went looking. I needed to move some milk. You know, milk is not something you can keep around all the time.
Right.
So I hopped on the internet and I came across, I had, was already familiar with the Weston A. Price Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I made a contact through there and I said, hey, I have milk and I need to move it. Do you have anybody? Anyway, in 3 days, we had standing orders for all the milk that we could produce. Excellent. Which at that time was only 3 cows.
But right.
It the internet has been 100% of our growth for the first several years, and then it has gone to word of mouth beyond
right,
that.
Right. So the business models in the modern age, even in something as ancient as farming, is very significantly influenced by this new communication technology that we have available to us.
You know, it's amazing because the amount that you can learn, you know, it's so much faster because you can scan through a website and pick the parts that need to apply to you versus reading a whole book. And I'm not knocking books because I've learned a ton from there too, but it just sped things up.
Mm-hmm. So, it's the same thing with just about anything. I compare the internet to Gutenberg's press. It's changing society and culture in a number of different categories, and pretty much all culture. Yeah. We're evolving as a species thanks to this communication device. So I want to go to a couple things that what makes you your produce special? I mean, what is different about what I'm going to get at the grocery store versus coming up to Hidden Hills Farms and getting the produce? We're going to get into milk more specifically in a little bit, but let's mm-hmm. look at some of the other stuff, some of the plant-based produce you put out and different things you talk about.
The produce specifically, there are lots of terms that people know, have heard through the media, but maybe do not understand accurately what mm-hmm. they mean. Organic, grown naturally, heirloom is mm-hmm. something else that's a kind of a new trendy thing now. Mm-hmm. I have always, for 15 years, I've always grown with heirloom seeds.
And what is heirloom seeds? What does that mean?
Heirloom are open pollinated varieties that have not been crossed. If you cross two varieties, then you have an F1 hybrid. And it's not bad to cross. A lot of times your plants are going to do it naturally. Mm-hmm. So it's not a bad thing. What's bad is when they cross it to the point that, one, you can't save seeds because you don't know what the seeds will grow to be like. And two, they're breeding them to be so disease resistant, pest resistant, and things like that. They're focusing just on production of a shell. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I hope in time people can understand. Even if something is marked organic or naturally grown, it doesn't necessarily mean it was grown in nutrient-dense soil.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean it was picked at the right time. So you're getting a shell that's labeled,
right,
this is organic or whatever the
right
case may be.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of organic myself. I'm much more promoted of locally grown.
Correct. And so that's a term that's just really come up here in the last 3 years mm-hmm. with great education. And I really would prefer that people focus a lot more on their local produce than they do, you know, going to Whole Foods or something like that to get organic. Now, they both have their merits, mm-hmm. I mean, organic and local, but here's the long story short. Organic is going to be chemical or not. If it's organic, it's going to be non-chemical. Local, what you're hoping for, not always getting, but what you're hoping for is that it's been picked within just a day, a couple days before you're able to get it. And any item that you harvest starts losing nutritional value.
Immediately.
From the time, exactly. And so the point is that the most ideal situation is for everybody to grow things in their own backyard.
Sure.
And to reach out and grab it right before the meal.
Right.
But if you can't do that, you need to be able to get it harvested really soon. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people have turned to farmers markets or with what people do with us and directly come to the farm.
Right, right. Now, this affects so many different things. I was thinking about it the other day is the cost in carbon footprinting, which is kind of the big that everybody's talking about nowadays, of transporting food from one half of the country to the other or one half of the world to the other. Just the cost in the transport makes it uneconomical to do that kind of business anymore. We really need to move more to a locally grown, locally distributed, locally consumed kind of economy. And that's exactly what you're vanguarding here. Yeah. As far as afford. So local, natural. And the other thing I like about locally grown, because you can check your farmer out.
Exactly.
You know, you can get involved in the process and go check them out. And that if you, when you go to the market and you get to know this guy, if he's selling crap, mm-hmm. you don't go back. You know,
well, the thing that you will find a lot when you go to farmers markets, there's still a veil there. Mm-hmm. And what I know from personal experience, I was a consumer way before I was a farmer. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot along the way. And I learned that just because a farmer takes items to the farmer's market doesn't necessarily always mean they produced it.
Right.
Even if they've signed a contract, a lot of market managers ask that you sign a contract stating that you produced it. Mm. It's not always kept to. I know a lot of farmers that get it through other means, and they're not always grown to the same standards.
Right, right. Because they want to put something on the shelf because they're paying for that space.
Exactly.
And you can see the pressure that they're under.
Well, one thing that you mentioned something that brought up an idea, and the thing that we have gotten so used to is walking in a grocery store and seeing just a plethora of different items available.
Right.
And that's not the natural system. Mm-mm. The natural system is for there to be an abundance of a few things, you know, throughout the year. And, you know, we're here in Kansas City, and people think, well, sure, if I live up north, I'd have nothing to eat in the winter. Then, well, that's not true. We grow in unheated high tunnels or hoop houses mm-hmm. Through the wintertime, and it's taken us a while to really grasp how to do that. But it's very doable here mm-hmm. in Kansas City. You don't have to waste fossil fuels to do it. You don't have to heat the space. Mm-hmm. It is possible to do. You know.
Well, you know, when I in my travels across China, one of the things that I noticed is if you have the opportunity to own a building, you've usually inherited it from 2 or 3 or 10 generations down, and the front yard is not grass; it's a goat, or it's these little bamboo and plastic domes mm-hmm. that they have that they rotate around, and they grow vegetable crops all year round. And their climate is exactly like it here in Kansas City because of these technologically advanced bamboo and plastic like semi-circle domes that they just move around the front yard.
That's exactly what we have.
Mm-hmm. But you got different. A big one though. I've been
we
up
do.
There.
We do have a big one. And the first off, the dome, I just have to say, the dome structure itself is so ideal from a small one that you're using to grow maybe just a small amount of produce in. Mm-hmm. This year we'll be constructing an enormous one to house our livestock in the wintertime when the weather's really bad. We graze in throughout the year. Amazing. And they're very inexpensive to build yourself. Obviously, it's a scale.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. So you do chickens, milk, grown produce.
We have 5 kinds of meat, mm-hmm. Produce that we produce year-round, mm-hmm. Dairy items from our dairy cows, and eggs.
And do you do any processing of the dairy items at all? Is it just the raw milk, or do you do any kind of like cheeses or anything like that?
A little bit of everything. I make several hard cheeses. I make several soft cheeses. I make butter. I make ice cream. This was a process for me of trying to feed my own family. Uh-huh. It wasn't a process of, hey, I'm going to make a business out of this. I wanted to feed my family well. So I taught myself how to make cottage cheese and sour cream and cream cheese. And the amount, it's amazing what you can do with a gallon of milk. It really is. People just don't, you know, it takes somebody that's going to take, it's time. People
yeah.
have to be willing to put time in.
Time into the food. I mean, that's kind of a good place to put your time.
Yeah, true.
Okay, so how are we doing?
We're fine.
Okay.
You've
got
plenty of time.
Excuse me. Okay, so my daughter has been hitting me up to raise chickens in the backyard. All right.
I think you should.
So I told her in Kansas City, you can't have chickens in the backyard. Here's what she did. She went to the internet. She's 11 years old. She went to kansascity.org, the website, and looked up the ordinance on chickens in your backyard.
Oh, you raise good kids.
Well, guess what? You can have chickens in your backyard in Kansas City. Matter of fact, you can have up to 14 hens in a neighborhood house as long as they're at least 100 feet from anybody else's house.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's a lot of regulations on roosters because I guess roosters are really
loud.
Kind of a pain and mm-hmm. loud and stuff like that. They got to be like 300 feet from anybody's house. But you can have up to 14 birds. That's a lot of chickens, right?
Yes.
I mean, how much space would it take to make 14 birds happy?
Really? Go back to the hoop. If mm-hmm. you could take a hoop and you were dedicated about keeping it moved, because mm-hmm. those girls need fresh grass to move on to. It wouldn't take too much space. It depends on if you keep them in an open bottom hoop that you could drag across the ground.
Yeah, the chicken tractor.
Exactly.
Yeah, I saw one of those on the internet. That was pretty neat.
I'd have to do the math again to see exactly how many square feet you needed for 14, but it's not too bad.
So say I got four chickens. If I had four chickens, that were egg layers, and she actually did the research on which ones were the best meat and which ones were the best egg layers, and she had all this stuff all laid out for me because
she's working on you.
No, she is. She is, and I'm all a go on it, but my wife's still like, you know what? We don't need chickens in our backyard.
Uh oh, you shouldn't have told me.
You know, well, Christina's probably listening right now too. So, how many eggs a week can you get out of four birds?
It depends on the breed. If you get some sort of, first off, there's production birds, which are bred for high production. And I normally suggest people to stay away from those. But you can also cross two heritage birds to get a fairly good production bird. On just a standard heritage breed of chicken, you can probably get about a 50% lay rate average throughout the whole year.
Now, what does that mean?
Count the number of days in a year, 365, right. And one hen, you'll get an egg every other day from her.
So if you had four hens in a week, you're basically going to get,
two a day. You'd get 14.
Yeah, more than a dozen eggs a week off of the four hens.
There's a lot of factors that go into that would change that. The first year that they're laying, they lay a lot heavier. A lot of times you might get almost an egg a day out of all of them. Each year that they get older, they go back less and less. That's why I was kind of saying an average. But if you cross two heritage birds and get what I call is a little more of a heritage production bird, you can get about an 80% lay rate.
Oh, wow. Nice. So how old do they get before their time for the skillet?
Well, because we run a business, we do it a little different. Every season, spring and fall, we bring in a fresh batch, and there's always a cycle. There's a cycle of young ones coming in, they go through what we call two cycles, and then once they get to their third cycle, we go ahead and butcher them for that. Older hens make the absolute best chicken stock. Don't raise meat birds for chicken stock. Right. Older hens have the flavor. You're going to get more of a gelatinous product from them. Yeah, it's far superior.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. So I want to move over to the milk side of things. Okay, we've got lots to talk about on this. First of all, what I want you to do is describe the difference between raw milk and grocery store milk.
Okay, I'm going to break this down from the science to just the real plain Jane. Raw milk comes from the cow. Ours comes from the cow, goes through a filter. It's not heated. It does not go through any process. Pasteurization is the process of heating milk to the point that it kills all the bacteria in milk. Good bacteria, bad bacteria. It also denatures the protein structure, which is why many people have a hard time digesting it. Homogenization is a process. Essentially, they shoot milk through these very, very fine sprayers, and it breaks up the structure so that the fats float throughout the milk instead of rise to the top, which is the natural.
Right.
And so these are two processes that are meant to extend shelf life. It's meant to, you know, pasteurization was not developed for milk. A lot of people think that. It was actually developed for the beer and wine industry. And they applied it to milk during a time when there were a lot of inner city dairies that were very, very dirty. They had sick animals, and they were putting out sick milk, essentially. And that became the way to equalize everything. They were taking dirty milk, this is my terminology, sick milk, and making it so that it was still usable.
Right. Now, I have relatives down in southern Missouri that have been in the dairy industry for generations.
There's a lot of dairy down there.
There is. And they're pretty proud of it. But, you know, they're very frustrated with the system now. But I've been through the process of the milking the cows and the pus formations and the different things that they are dealing with. And
mastitis.
Yeah, and how they just process it through because they know it's going to be pasteurized and run down. The stuff that's getting through this is really, really gross.
It's like a free pass.
When I come up to your place, you know, and you car wash your cows, you know, I mean, you keep everything just clean. You can see what's going on.
That's true, by the way.
I know. You got some very clean cows up there, except right after it rains.
Yeah.
But the attention to detail and how you take care of from the cows, the calves, all the way up through. I mean, it shows up in the quality of the food that you present.
Well, thank you.
So a little more on the people understand that the pasteurization or the boiling of this product. When Jennifer said denature the proteins, what that means is you've got this nutrient that your body recognizes as food when it's in its whole form. But when you boil it down and break up those molecules into smaller, and through the pasteurization, they boil it down, and then the homogenization is a very violent way of chopping up the molecules, the fat molecules and the protein molecules, into really small little microns so that they stay blended and pretty on the shelf. But in the meantime, you're turning these full rich proteins, some of which we have no idea what they are. I mean, as far as their nutritional ability in your body, and you're breaking them down into monosodium glutamate. I mean, you're literally making a toxic brew out of something that was once very wholesome and whole.
Yes.
And what I found, and you mentioned this as well, is you see a lot of people that have dairy allergies, but they're not allergic to dairy. They're allergic to pasteurized dairy.
Yes.
So once you've murdered the milk and turned it into this chemical concoction, of course your living immune system is not very happy with that. So it creates...
It doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't know how to process it.
It defends itself with mucus. It builds mucinogens. It causes... And what I found in drinking your milk, and about 4 or 5 years we've been using your milk now? We've raised our kids on it?
It's been quite... Yes. Mm-hmm. They were little.
They were. And I can take an 8-ounce or 10-ounce glass of your milk and slug it down like a sports drink. And normally, and I know everybody out there that if you do drink milk, you know that little full feeling you feel in your stomach just kind of feels like there's just a big old lump in there. Nada. That does not happen with raw milk. It absorbs so fast. I mean, by the time you get it swallowed and into the stomach, the enzymes are already going to work. Everything is breaking down, and you get this energy boost. It's the kind of the best energy drink I've ever drank. And it's just grab the milk, shake it up a little bit, pour it down. It tastes like ice cream. It's awesome.
It does. It really does taste like ice cream. You know, when I first started, when I concocted the idea to get dairy cows, it was for the intention of providing my family with raw milk. Mm-hmm. I had had raw milk as a consumer before I started farming, and I have grown up with a varied amount of allergies and my own health issues that I've battled. And that was one of the things that instantly provided me different levels of relief. And it's funny how a lot of people with allergies of different kinds, and I'm not just tying in the lactose intolerance, which is just kind of it's just a label that's used very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
But even down to things such as hay fever and things like that, there are people that have experienced relief. I'm not saying it's going to do it good for everybody in every situation.
Sure.
I'm not a doctor.
We're not a panacea here. You know,
exactly. So. But it is the situation where it provides improvement. It helps support the immune system. Really, raw milk still has the digestive enzymes in it, where pasteurized milk does not. And that's huge. Where are you getting digestive enzymes unless you're taking supplements? There are a few limited foods that have it. And we normally cook our food so much, it's gone.
Right.
So you're getting a proper protein, you're getting digestive enzymes, and if you are so lucky to get unpasteurized milk that is 100% grass-fed,
right,
which is a whole nother topic on its own, you're getting a fatty acid profile that's out of this world.
Now, fatty acid profile, I was going to ask you that specifically. A lot of people are, and even your cardiologists and stuff, are starting to get on board with this essential fatty acids, these fish oils. Now, I understand, and maybe you can correct me on this, isn't raw milk, doesn't it have an EPA profile? It has a essential fatty acids profile, omega-3s and omega-6s?
It does, if it's 100% grass-fed.
Okay.
If you are getting raw milk from a source that's feeding them corn, or feeding them corn soybean mix, or really any kind of a grain item, what that's doing is it's raising the omega-6s, which were your point is to get the omega-3s. Most people don't realize there's omega-3s in the grasses and a lot of the beneficial weeds that are in the pasture. And those cows graze that all the time. So, you know, you get told to either take fish oil capsules or eat salmon to get higher amounts of omega-3. Well, there are some people that are good about taking them all the time, but normally most people don't eat salmon every single night.
Sure.
But we drink milk all the time. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting like this, it's a lighter level, yes, but you're getting it all the time.
Right.
And so you're getting this omega-3s coming into your body, and it's very beneficial. And then if you're so lucky that you go that direction with your meat as well, you're getting even more from your meat products.
All right. So we're going to take a first break, Jennifer. And then when we come back, I want to go a little bit more into the milk and the quality of the food. And then we're going to talk about how we can help you continue your business and maybe spread this out a little bit more and get more people involved.
Excellent.
In this kind of thing. Thank you.
Jackalope 105 FM. It's time to rock your routine. Music that matters and not the same old talk. It's time for real variety. It's time for Jackalope 105 FM. The real alternative. Rock your routine. Jackalope105FM.com.
Welcome back to Minutes in the Memories. This is Dr. Drum right here with my good friend Jennifer Charlson. We're talking about sustained farming and small farms in the local rural communities. Jennifer, we were talking about the nutritional quality of the milk that you produce as far as raw. Now, there's some other things that you do with the milk, kefir and different things like that. I mean, you like?
Yeah, kefir is a fermented milk product. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sound good? Most people are like,
it's beer. I mean, fermented. Yeah. I think of beer when you think fermented products. I mean,
well, so many people think that once milk goes bad, it's awful. Mm-hmm. When if you take out the pasteurization process, mm-hmm. and if you take milk and let it age naturally, it just begins to sour, mm-hmm. and it's just the first step of the next stage of its life. Mm-hmm. You're going into making cheese or something like that. You know, cheese is basically soured milk.
Right.
So anyway, back to the kefir. Kefir is a probiotic, mm-hmm. and it's really phenomenal if somebody spends the time to read the history behind it, because nobody really knows where it comes from. The little mother cultures are called grains, but they're not a grain. They look like little cottage cheese curdles, mm-hmm. and science is unable to duplicate them. Hmm. And so the only way you can get them is to get a starter from somebody else.
Okay.
Which is pretty cool. And everybody passes starters on to each other. You put it in
kind of like a friendship bread.
You know? Exactly. Exactly. You put it in milk and it eats off of the milk sugars.
Okay.
Which means if somebody's having an issue with milk sugars, if they drink the kefir once it's finished its process, it's much easier to digest than even just the straight raw milk if somebody's super sensitive.
So what is the milk sugar? What is it that people are avoiding? Is there a name for that sugar? Is it
the lactase?
Lactase. Mm-hmm. Well, lactase is the enzyme.
Lactose. Yeah. Sorry.
That's no problem.
Yeah. And so the kefir is a probiotic that I think has, I'd have to look one more time, but I think it's 30 times more probiotic strains, beneficial bacteria strains, than a really good quality yogurt.
Okay.
And so, you know, yogurt versus kefir, kefir's just going to knock it out of the park. People that have all sorts of GI issues have hugely benefited. Now, it is tartar than yogurt. It's thinner. It's more of a pourable type situation. It makes great smoothies. Okay. You can freeze it and make fruit pops for your kids. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And I am starting to experiment with making kefir cheese.
Right. We talked about this before. When the milk, when I buy the milk from you, it's good in the refrigerator for up to about 2 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. As long as they keep it cold.
Cold.
But then you've also talked about, since it's very clean milk, that even when it starts, what did you call it?
As it starts aging, it's souring.
But it's not actually spoiling.
Exactly.
There's not any kind of like rotten or bacteria or anything going crazy there. It's just actually going through a life process.
That's exactly right. If there was not the bacteria in it, the very first day it was bottled when it was fresh,
right.
It's not going to have that bacteria in it 6 months later.
Right.
And so you essentially could leave it in wherever, out on a counter even for 6 months. Now, when you open it, it's going to smell horrible and your taste buds are going to object.
Right.
But it's not going to make you ill.
Okay. Okay.
The beneficial bacteria in there takes over if there was not bad bacteria to start with.
Right.
Now, the one thing for people that are looking for raw milk, one thing that is very important is to find a farmer that does test their cattle mm-hmm. for cattle diseases. There's a lot of them that don't.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that they don't produce wonderful milk.
Right.
I'm just, from a safety standpoint, it's something, we're in Missouri, it's not required in the state of Missouri. Mm-hmm. We do it. I would highly recommend it. It's not very expensive. Other farmers should.
Just have a veterinarian, what, do blood tests or something like that?
Really, we do all the tests ourselves except for two of them. And then, yes, the vet can come out and do tuberculosis and yonase testing, but you can send in blood for mm-hmm. some of the other ones. And actually, some of the labs are starting to let you do blood tests for yonase too. But anyway, yonase, BVD, BLV, and TB are big diseases that should be tested for, in my opinion.
And you find a cow that comes up with this. If your whole farm's clean, if you're bringing on a fresh cow, of course, you're going to be very picky about having that cow tested to bring it into your clean pasture.
To give a kind of geeky farmy example of that, we are expanding this year, mm-hmm. and I scoured all over the United States to find a cow to fit my protocol. They're extremely difficult to find, and I found a guy in Nebraska that we're going to go buy cows from that follows the same testing protocol as we do, raises them 100% grass like we do. Mm-hmm. They're extremely expensive, mm-hmm. and they're worth it.
Okay. Now, I noticed that you had some calves out there last time I was up there, and you let the calves stay with their mom.
Yeah.
Right?
Isn't that amazing?
Well, tell me, because the other ways that people do that, they sequester the calf away from the mom for some reason. Yeah. I mean, what's the thinking behind that?
Oh, gosh, I could talk about this for a long time, but I'm going to keep it as short as I can. The traditional dairy industry pulls the calves off to get the maximum amount of milk.
So that the farmer gets the maximum amount
of milk. The farmer has
the
maximum.
So the cow's not drinking all the milk.
The calf isn't drinking it all, yeah. Basically, a cow has an ability to, it's called holding up her milk. Mm-hmm. She chooses when it flows and when it stops. Mm. And she has four quarters in her udder, and she can choose to hold up them individually.
Wow.
Tell me that's not a skill.
Yeah.
And so if she's feeding her calf, she might decide that the farmer doesn't need any and she's not going to give it to him. And that's it. And so it's a management. It does become tricky. You have to train your girls to accept you as a calf.
Yeah.
And it's a process we've spent some time on, but it's worth it.
Right.
So essentially the cow and the calf for the first several weeks that after the calf's been born, they stay together 24/7 and right. we milk the extra that the calf can't drink.
Right.
Beyond that, depending on the calf and several other factors, then the calf spends 12 hours on pasture with the other calves and 12 hours on pasture with its mom. So it cycles in and out. It gets its mom for 12 hours of the day. And then the second 12 hours, she's building milk in her udder, and we milk her at the end of that 12-hour period, right. And that's when we just milk for.
So when does a baby cow start eating grass?
They will mimic their mother from the time they're very young, and mm-hmm. that's really a huge factor with raising the calves alongside their mothers. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that it should be automatic. You throw an animal out there, and they should just know how to do things, and there's a lot of instinct that comes in play. But you've got to understand, we raise our children and we teach them what's right and what's wrong and mm-hmm. how to stay away from certain things and certain things you need. Well, cows do the same thing. They teach, you know, they're very self-medicating for different things. They will seek out different things to eat if they need it. Mm. And those traits are taught and they're passed on from generation to generation. Yet you have all these calves that have been bottle raised, and the humans come in and give them a bottle twice a day, and then just poof, throw them out on pasture, or they start feeding them grain. So it's basically they're taking what the human gives them,
right?
Instead of being taught how to go through the pasture and graze properly,
actually be an animal out there.
Exactly.
So you're on a Missouri field. The grass is basically around from what, March through November.
Yeah, and depending on the year, and a lot of times grass doesn't even come in real well till the 1st of April.
And I noticed that the milk tastes a little different when that first.
Oh, yeah, and that's the reality of raw milk that's grass-fed. I had mm-hmm. this conversation 2 days ago with somebody that was new. The milk is going to change in flavor, period. You need to know that up front.
Right.
There's lots of things you can do to mask it, and we don't. Grain right. is one of them. Grain's kind of a great neutralizer. Mm-hmm. Pulling them off the pasture is one of them, and we don't do that either, because that's when if you follow Weston A. Price's teachings, that's when the activator X is the strongest, is when that grass flush is coming in right there at the beginning of the year.
Right.
It's also when the milk's the strongest, mm-hmm. and a lot of people don't like it during that time, and that's fine if they don't want to drink it. It normally doesn't take too long for it to come back, but it does get strong. Very strong for tasting.
Yeah, it's a little bitter.
Yeah.
A little bit. And you can actually see the green in the milk, too, during that time.
It gets so bright. And the colors, it's very rainbow-like to watch it start changing colors. But, yeah.
You say you have chickens, you have cows, and sometimes you have pigs, too.
Yes.
But tell me about what's special about the way you do pigs. I think that's pretty cool.
Can I just real quick, say my birthday's in 2 days, and I'm buying myself a heritage breed piglet that is extremely hard to find. How geeky is that? I am going to buy myself a pig, and I'm so excited about it. Okay. So anyway, we raise heritage breed animals as much as we possibly can. We started with Berkshire pigs, and they have become fairly popular enough that they're not really as much of a true heritage animal. And what heritage animals are ones that have not been bred so much that they're just for production.
Right.
And so Berkshires are known very well to be well marbled meat. They're phenomenal eating pigs. But a lot of people have messed with their genetics and have made them to the American traditional lean hog, which is not really what they should be. You know, back in the 50s when everything needed to be super lean and fat free, well, that's what they did with pork and made it the other white meat. Well, pork's supposed to be pretty red.
Right.
So anyway, long story short, we're going to start raising what are called large black hogs, and they're extremely rare and hard to find, and that's why I'm buying myself a piglet, because I'm so thrilled. The meat is phenomenal. It's marbled. It's red. It's juicy. It stays juicy. A lot of times you get pork chops, and they're dry.
Mm-hmm. You're making me hungry, you know.
I'm sorry. I had a really interesting phone call today, and I'll just do this for 15 seconds. But I answered the phone, and this guy I could hardly understand started asking me about pigs. And I was like, I could not understand him. I'm not good at listening to people with accents. And I said, can you tell me where you're from? And he said, I'm from Italy. And I can't do a good Italian accent. And he said, I need pigs that haven't been raised on soybeans. I can't find them anywhere in the United States. Hmm. And so he's in Virginia, and he calls me, and he said, will you please raise me pigs? He wants to make prosciutto, which is, you know, pretty phenomenal. This guy comes from a long history in Italy of this. So anyway, yeah, we have some pretty special pigs.
Excellent. Excellent.
I don't know if I answered your question.
No, but also, I mean, the lineage of the pigs is cool, but the way you move them around the field and these kind of things. And I mean, let's talk about the cleanliness of the pigs and what pigs in their natural habitat are like versus what you normally see on a farm.
Yeah. First off, pigs are omnivores.
Okay. Which means
they eat both plant matter and animal matter.
Kind of like humans.
Exactly.
You know, in anatomy, when I was going through, you know, chiropractic school and medical school before that, the reason why we dissect pigs is because their alimentary canal, from the mouth all the way through, is very similar to a human's. They have the same similar length of small intestine for absorption, and the pancreas and all these kind of organ systems are very similar to the human beings as omnivores. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, pigs are great. We raise them in a very special way, which I think is really funny that I say that because it's really just it's how they should be raised. Mm-hmm. Pigs like to forage through the woods, essentially, and they will live out on pasture. Pigs love thistles. You know, they dig up different types of weeds. So our pigs are not raised in pig pens. Mm-hmm. And people get this thought in their mind that pigs are dirty and nasty. Well, you'd be dirty and nasty if you lived in a 10 by 10 pen all the time, too.
Yeah. Yeah, never let out.
So we raise our pigs out on grass. And as we progress with our farm a little bit, we're going to go past the grass and go back into the oak trees, which acorn finished pork is pretty much the top of the ladder in the pig world. But beyond that, we rotate them through different spaces, different grass spaces, and we allow them to root. And, you know, because they dig up a whole lot of weeds, it's really fantastic. They are destructive, a little bit destructive to pastures too, but it's tolerable. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we feed them milk. Mm. And we feed them the excess milk away from when we make cheese or from milking the cows or whatever. Yeah. And they're quite phenomenal. So instead of raising pigs on the commercial industry of a pelletized corn and soy mix, they get a lot of alfalfa from us. We actually custom mix our own stuff, and it's kind of an alfalfa base. So they do get some supplemental feed, and then they graze out on pasture.
Now, is there any plants out there that you don't want the animals getting into that you have to, like, manage the land and keep certain plants off?
There are, but where we're at, for the most part, in the grasslands, you're going to be dealing with a few different weeds. When you mentioned the milk-changing flavor earlier, sometimes that's also a weed issue. Mm-hmm. And there are a few weeds that you watch in the spring, but that comes down to a flavor of the milk issue. The pigs pretty much can tolerate anything. Mm-hmm. The things that they can't tolerate, they naturally, instinctively stay away from.
Just don't eat it. Make them sick once. They're smart enough to, like, you know, I'm not eating that again.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure there's an exception to that rule. Somebody out there is going to go, oh, wait, I had a pig that ate something. But for the most part, they know what not to eat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you let them wander around, and you got acorns going on back there.
Oh.
And so everything's expanding and doing well. So what I'm going to move on to is what obstructions? I mean, because it's always been interesting to me is I have to go to you to get my milk. Why can't I just get the milk at the store? Why can't I have the option?
Dun, it's illegal.
Illegal.
Yeah. Really, it's illegal to buy in the state of Missouri raw milk straight from the grocery store. I'm actually glad that in the state of Missouri you can buy it straight from the farmer, because there are other states that you flat out cannot get it. It cannot be given to you.
There was an article down in Florida where they have these raw milk organizations that meet in the grocery store parking lot, and they have these clandestine, they call it pet food or something like that, and you go out there and out of the trunk of somebody's car.
It's like,
and
the black market.
Yeah, you know, it's like
for milk.
Well, anytime you create a prohibition, you know, you're gonna create a market, and you increase the value. So maybe with all this stuff, you're making more money off your milk than you could if it was actually being able to brought to the store. You never know. I don't mind driving out there though. I enjoy the ride out. So it's illegal to bring it to the store.
It's illegal to have it in the store, to sell it from the store.
Okay.
You can, in the state of Missouri, every state's a little different. In the state of Missouri, you can buy it from the farmer, or the farmer can deliver it directly to the consumer. We don't.
Right.
but it can be done.
Because of costs, and there's only two of you out there, and plus a couple of hired hands here and there, so you don't have really time. The resources or time to or a truck or anything like that.
Exactly. So what we do, I won't get too far down this because this is a whole different thing. I would prefer that if you have a farmer close to you to make that drive, because it puts your eyes on that land.
Right.
That is important. You mentioned that earlier.
It is.
But anyway, it's the state milk board in each state can pretty much controls how milk is regulated, sold, and the dairy industry in general finds raw milk very threatening, and they would much prefer that farmers just did not sell raw milk, that it all went through the milk tanks, through the milk trucks, and through the manufacturing process. They say it's to protect you. That is their claim, is, hey, we're going to protect you.
Sounds familiar.
We're from the government. We're here to save you. But the thing is that people have they're very intelligent. They have the ability to go research themselves and to gain the knowledge they need to pick a quality farmer to get their food from.
Right. So on a free market system, if we were to let that happen, that if you have quality, you would be successful. And if you didn't have quality, you wouldn't be successful.
Correct.
So you depend on the consumer to actually be intelligent and smart enough to be responsible for what he's consuming, and not just say, oh, we have the FDA, or oh, we have a government entity that's going to protect me, I can just take it off the shelf and it's always going to be the same because somebody else is responsible for that.
Well, that's the one thing about buying from a farmer. You're not getting a uniform product all the time,
right,
over and over again, and please don't expect that.
Right. It's not going to be a McDonald's where everything is actually the
because
same. Because
that expectation is a lot of the problem that has driven several different things in the food industry. You need to understand there are different seasons, different times of the year, food changes. But anyway, back to the milk. It is definitely something that people are smart enough to educate themselves, to choose their own farmer, and they don't have to rely on the FDA or whomever to constantly say, this is what you can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. But anyway, as you know, that's a battle that's ever going.
Sure. You know, as a chiropractor, it's kind of along the same lines that we've always had. So a lot of our listeners aren't from Kansas City. We have listeners from all across the country. Do you know of any resources that they can access? Obviously, the internet's going to be one, but any kind of websites that you correspond with that actually they can find a raw farmer in their area?
If you're looking for raw milk, check out realmilk.com.
Well, that's easy enough.
Very easy. It's run by the Weston A. Price Foundation, which I would highly recommend people at least inquire into just reading some of their. They focus on traditional foods. Mm-hmm. Excellent information. The other place you can find farmers, you will find both raw milk farmers and just grass-based farmers, is a website called eatwild.com.
Eatwild.com. Excellent. And these will have contacts around the
all
country?
All over the United States. Mm-hmm. They've got, both of them have listings from all, I don't know about all. Yeah, I think all 50 states.
Mm-hmm. So what is the difference between cow's milk and goat's milk? You see people that say that goat's milk's better than cow's milk. Why would they say that?
That is a major debate. Let's see if I can keep this short.
Oh, you don't have to. We're
there,
okay.
There is, okay, goat's milk has its benefits. Mm-hmm. Cow's milk has its benefits. Cow's milk has folic acid. Mm-hmm. Goat's milk doesn't.
Okay.
The protein structure in goat's milk is smaller. And to break this down even further, there's different breeds of cows that actually put out milk that's much more similar to goats, meaning that the protein structure is smaller. And so there has been this... I'm not going to say it's just bad information, because it started out good information, but it's been applied wrong. Goat's milk is going to be good in certain situations, but we happen to crossbreed with a cow, and it's the breed is called Normandy. They also have a different protein structure that's much more similar to goat's milk.
Oh, okay.
So you can get cow's milk that is of a different structure. Not every breed's going to put out exactly the same. You're going to have higher butter fat or lower butter fat in different breeds. You're going to have slightly different protein. So there are... it's not really one is better than the other. There's people that prefer both ways, but it's really funny because there's a lot of people in the goat industry that say... you know, this is better. Goat's milk is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think they're both good.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody actually would have like a small 1 acre or something like that, it probably would be easier for them to have a goat.
Definitely.
Than it would be to try to do a cow.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So So as we come to the close of this, I want to thank you again very much for being here. You know, I really appreciate talking to this. And these are going on files for future reference. So please use this and refer to this as anything needed, anybody interested in the milk. Is there anything at all that I can do to help you continue your business and keep going? Is there any politics or any kind of legislation that we need to worry about? Is there anything that's bothering you or worried about you that we need to definitely bring to attention?
Every year, everybody, this goes coast to coast, go get involved at your state level. Mm-hmm. There's legislation every year that affects the small farmer. Mm-hmm. The farm bill that goes through always has threatening information. Get involved. You know, I could sit and pick out different specific things, but just go get involved at your state level every year.
Mm-hmm. And then you can go to these websites that we mentioned and you can find a local farmer
in
your area.
Support your local farmer. You have a mechanic, you have an attorney.
Right.
Have a farmer.
Yeah. Know where your food's coming from.
Exactly.
I mean, when you put something in your mouth, and I've talked about this before, a lot of what's called food in America today is not food at all. It's a processed chemical. Just call it a drug.
Yeah.
You know, I have nothing against drugs, but call it what it is. If it's food, it was alive recently. It's still alive, yeah. like the milk is. If it's white powdery substance that's been processed and boiled down and comes out of a factory someplace, yeah it might taste good. You know, it might excite your tongue a little bit, but that is not food, yeah. And you're going to have a lot of problems with it. I did want to say one more thing on the raw milk that we never brought up is skin conditions. My one of my children very likely would have developed an eczema problem because he has kind of a dry skin. But thanks to you and the raw milk that we feed him and he devours it, he's the biggest milk drinker in the house. His skin is smooth and supple all the time. And I really believe it's because of his access to such a wonderful food as the raw milk that we're able to give to him. All right, Todd, thank you very much for having us here tonight. This is Minutes to Memories on a Friday night. Everybody have another one on me. Happy hour. Have a great weekend in the summer. Coming to you from Kansas City in Zona Rosa, Jackalope Radio.
Don't criticize.